According to our next guest, a noble profession is facing its defining moment. From law schools to the prestigious firms that represent the pinnacle of a legal career, a crisis, he says, is unfolding. News headlines tell part of the story, the growing oversupply of new lawyers, widespread career dissatisfaction, and spectacular implosions of preeminent law firms. Yet eager hordes of bright young people continue to step over each day as they seek jobs with high rates of depression, life-consuming hours, and little assurance of financial stability. The Great Recession has only worsened these trends, but correction is possible and now imperative. All of these arguments made in the new book, The Lawyer Bubble, A Profession in Crisis. And our guest this morning is the author, Stephen Harper. It is a pleasure to have you with us. Stephen Harper is an adjunct professor at Northwestern University School of Law and Weinberg College of Arts and Sciences, and is a regular contributor to The American Lawyer and the author of three previous books. What brought you to this subject of the lawyer bubble?
Actually, it began probably with a course that I started teaching about 6 years ago. I had a very successful and, frankly, unusually pleasant, perhaps, career as a litigation attorney in a large law firm, and really enjoyed it. But it did become clear to me. It was becoming clear to me over the last 10 or 15 years that there were increasing levels of dissatisfaction, particularly among younger people in the profession. And I sort of started thinking about that in specific ways, and decided that one of the contributors was a failure of expectations. There are lots of young people, probably myself included at the time, who decided they wanted to be a lawyer after they watched To Kill a Mockingbird or Perry Mason or more recently L.A. Law or Law and Order, and decided, gee, wouldn't it be nice to be Alicia Florek and close out every day with a brutal cross-examination that won your case, even though you're only a second or a third year associate. And so I thought there was a sort of a failure of expectations, because the reality of being a lawyer has very little to do with some of those glorified images. And then, so I started teaching an undergraduate course at Northwestern, and it became clear to me that there really wasn't any kind of balanced treatment of the good, the bad, and the ugly of what it means to be a lawyer. And then, lo and behold, after I taught it the very first year, which was the winter of 2008, by year two, we'd hit the Great Recession, and the crisis was upon us, and all of a sudden, every time you picked up any kind of a newspaper or legal publication of any kind, there were big layoffs happening in big firms, and you know, the lawyer bubble actually was beginning to explode, the lawyer bubble being a vast oversupply of lawyers relative to the demand for them. So that's what it was, really the desire to provide something that I could use in an undergraduate course that prompted me to pursue the exercise of writing the book.
So why do you believe that the profession is in crisis? I mean, obviously you have described the way that it is often inaccurately portrayed, but for the working lawyer and even for the law student, how is the profession in crisis?
Well, here's the problem. You know, last week, ironically enough, we just got new job numbers, which show that we're still not adding significantly to the ranks of lawyers. In fact, last year we graduated 46,000 lawyers from the nation's law school. It was a record number of lawyers. And according to data that is just now being required to be disclosed by the American Bar Association, they're full-time jobs requiring a legal degree for about half of those new graduates. That's been true for a long time. The problem is that up until the class of 2011, law schools were able to count their graduates as new graduates, that is, as employed, if they had any kind of employment at all on February 15th, the year after they graduated. So, for example, if one of their graduates was a greeter at Walmart or waiting tables or a barista in a coffee shop, that person counted as employed, and there was no requirement that they break down the kind of job into short-term, part-time, long-term, or something that actually required a legal degree. Meanwhile, these students were coming out of law school with average law school educational debt of $100,000, all of which, the vast majority of which, is backed by the federal government and can't be discharged in bankruptcy. And so you have this very terrible perfect storm in which deans of law schools, frankly, have no incentives to do anything other than pump up their enrollments and pump up demand. The federal government is footing the bill by way of, at least temporarily, I guess I should say, by way of student funding of the whole thing. And then you need at that point is undergraduates, a collection of undergraduates who operate in the world, as many of us do, with sufficient confirmation bias that they want to embrace what fits their preconceived view of the world, as we all do, and jettison data that doesn't. And so you wind up with twice as many lawyers as you can employ. And the projection is that through the end of the decade, that situation will continue to worsen.
As you just alluded to, when you talk about law firms and law schools changing their goals, why are they changing those goals? What is it about that has said because of a business model saying, okay, we're going to change what we do?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And you know what the lawyer bubble is, and what the legal profession has become, is a slice of what ails America. And let me tell you what I mean by that. We have become, as a nation, obsessed with metrics. You know, we want to measure everything. And even worse than that, we've become obsessed with short-term metrics that very often sacrifice long-term values and long-term considerations. I'll just give you one example. Every law school dean in America now wants to be moving up and up and up in the U.S. News and World Report law school rankings. And they admit it. They started out when the rankings first came out in 1987. There were most deans, in fact, the vast majority of deans, condemned them because the methodology was so stupid and the underlying things that led to the ranking were sufficiently idiotic that they basically sent a letter to all prospective law students in 1995 that said, just don't pay any attention to these things. Make a decision based on reasoned judgment, not by the simplicity of a numerical solution that doesn't make any sense. Unfortunately, they couldn't hold on to that thought, and so what now happens is you have this frenzy to either maintain or keep moving up in the U.S. News Law School ranking, but the underlying methodology is actually absurd. For example, there's an incentive that the methodology gives you to increase your expenditures per student without regard to whether you're doing anything that adds value to the student's education. So what you're adding for sure is debt, because you're going to raise tuition, but you're doing it in a way that is completely perverse. And you can go through every single one of the key methodologies that lead to a U.S. News ranking, and anyone who understood it would say, boy, I wouldn't use whatever came out of this evaluation to buy a car, much less decide, you know, my future as a possible lawyer and where I should go to law school. But the incentives have been perverse. And if you carry that over into the large law firm world, the transformation has been a similar one, where we've had there the analog to the U.S. News rankings was something that came out in 1985 called the American Lawyer, annual rankings of the largest and most profitable law firms in the world. They started out as the Am Law 50. Now we're up to the Am Law 200. And every year, it's how do we move up on the list? And there are two ways you can move up. One is to be on the profits list, average profits per partner, and the second can be growth, biggest firm. But the problem is when you focus on something like next year's ranking, you're going to disregard, in many instances, disregard and ignore very important long-run aspects. In the case of law schools, it's the well-being of the student himself or herself. And in the case of law firms, it's the very stability of the institution, because you're so busy trying to maximize things in the short term that you don't realize the problems you're creating yourself for the long term.
You just used the word ignore, and I certainly don't want to ignore the debt issue because it's a huge issue. But in the time we have, I want to focus on something that I found to be especially fascinating, and you just alluded to it in your answer, having to do with the well-being of the student. You write in this book of the increased psychological distress that is facing these students, facing lawyers who are very early in their career, and quite frankly, even those who are or who are, have matured through the process of a legal career, and it's really quite staggering when you look at that.
It's depressing, to be honest. If you ask, the most recent poll of lawyers nationally by the American Bar Association found that 6 out of 10 lawyers who've been in practice 10 years or more affirmatively counsel young people to stay away from law school. Don't go. I mean, that's a sad comment on a profession. And I'm one of the four. I mean, I'm one of the four people that say, look, figure it out. Think about whether it fits with your personality and what you think your life's going to be, and learn everything you can before, you know, taking the plunge into the into the profession. So I'm one of the happy ones, I guess, one of the happy minority. But that's a staggering number if you think about it, over half of a profession that's, you know, really unhappy. And those are all people who, when they came out of law school, at least for the most part, have been able to get jobs. You know, now cut, you know, add on top of that the, what's happening now to half of today's graduates who can't even get jobs that require a legal degree, and it's pretty stunning.
You also address in the book how the older generation of lawyers is exploiting the younger generation. How so?
Well, that's an interesting problem, and it has to do with, again, with the thing we were talking about before. If you're trying to move up in the American lawyer rankings, for example, on average partner profits per partner, the way you can do that year after year after year is by electing fewer and fewer partners, new partners, into the partnership. So what you're doing essentially is you're pulling up the ladder on the generation behind you and increasing the wealth of those who are already in the club. And then if you want to take it another step, what's happening, even within the equity partnerships, there have been explosive growth, except for a handful of firms that have retained what is called lockstep compensation, which is the variation just is a function of how old you are and as you move through the partnership. But there have been staggering increases within equity partnerships between the very top performers and the very bottom of the equity partnership. So you have this tremendous concentration. Again, it's a mirror of what's happening in society. You know, if people talk about, you know, distribution of wealth and inequality and all that sort of stuff, you know, that game is over in big law firms. The people at the top have won, and it's taking a toll. And you pull up the ladder on the next generation in terms of opportunities, but you're doing it at great expense to the future of your institution, because at the end of the day, the only thing that any law firm of any kind can offer is the quality of its people. And if you don't have highly motivated, you know, intelligent people who really are concerned about their work and their clients and their institutions, then I think over the long haul you're going to be in some trouble. And I think, you know, that's one reason among many others that we've had some spectacular failures of law firms in the recent few years.
All right. So let's close by you telling me a happy story. When can it work?
I think it's beginning to work. The problem is it's working really slowly. It could work a lot better at the law school level. It could work a lot better if two really simple things happened. One, you allowed students who came out of law school to discharge their educational loans in bankruptcy. Currently, they can't. They're in the same category as alimony, child support, criminal fines, and back taxes. And in that group is also law school educational loans. And I think if you did that and then did one other thing with it, and then allowed the federal government, which is standing behind most of these loans, to go back to law schools and say, you know what, your graduates couldn't get jobs, and here's 10 of them, and because of that, they went into bankruptcy. We're now on the hook, and in an era of federal austerity, we think you need to become accountable, law school, university, whoever it is, that didn't take sufficient account of what was really happening, or frankly, deceive them into coming to law school in the first place. You're going to be on the hook financially for that, because right now there's a huge disconnect, and unless you do something to resolve that disconnect, you can't fix it. On the big law firm side, I think what's already begun to happen throughout many of the firms is a sufficient destabilization that it'll create brand new opportunities for young people, and I think it'll create opportunities to refashion and restructure the profession in a way that makes it, frankly, more pleasant and a more professional as opposed to business undertaking. But, you know, how long will that take? Who knows? But I have some optimism, and it comes in part from the students who I've been teaching for the last 6 years who are undergraduates, because they're taking a really hard look at what the generations ahead of them have been doing and the ways in which they're measuring success, and they're looking at it with a very, very skeptical eye. And I think many of them are deciding that they want something different, and for them it's going to be better, and I think it'll be better for the profession as well.
Stephen Harper teaches at Northwestern University's Law School and Weinberg College of Arts and Sciences. His new book is The Lawyer Bubble, A Profession in Crisis. It is published by Basic Books. Stephen Harper, a great pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you very much. I enjoyed it.
Thank you. Again, the name of the book, The Lawyer Bubble, A Profession in Crisis, published by Basic Books. You're listening to The Roundtable. on WAMC.